So when we look at this, we're looking at the CNS. We're going to look at five conditions. Before, we're going to look at some normal or five areas and some examples of conditions that can occur within the CNS, including the spinal cord, obviously attached to the brain. So we have to look at these structures. This is the outside of the brain, the meninges. Does anybody know what meninges means? It means a membrane. So these are membranes. There's three membranes that cover your CNS. The toughest one is called the dura mater. When it's against the calvarium or the skull, you have in there, you have the middle meningeal artery, which is in the middle right here where your temporal bone is. Then below the dura, you have the subdural space where veins traverse to the superior sagittal sinus, drain the brain, cerebral hemispheres. Then you come into subarachnoid space, which has a CSF, cerebrospinal fluid, and you have vessels, arteries. And another important thing you always have to remember clinically is that another set of structures that run in the cerebrospinal fluid for a short period of time are all 12 cranial nerves and your ventral and dorsal rami in your spinal cord. Why am I pointing out those two important structures? Because if you have an inflammation of the meninges, meningitis, whether it's acute or chronic, those structures can be damaged, whether it's your ventral or dorsal rami, whether it's your 12 cranial nerves, which are going to be the base of the brain, obviously, and then you worry about the vessels becoming inflamed, you get a vasculitis, thrombosis, infarction as a complications of meningitis. So it's important to understand what structures are involved in these areas, and then when you have diseases, you understand why they occur the way they do. And when it becomes important, when we talk about various hemorrhages, epidural, subdural, subarachnoid hemorrhage, understanding what vessels. Yes? Yes, they will go through that. It's correct. They go through a short period of distance through there. And that becomes important to realize. Let me turn on, forgot the mic here. Testing 1, 2, 3. There we go. Since people are all the way up in there in the low oxygen area of the auditorium. So that's important to understand. That's why this image is shown here to tell you where these spaces are and what happens when you have various hemorrhages, bleeding. So there's the epidural, subdural, subarachnoid, and the brain parenchyma. When we talked about the Schwann cells are part of the peripheral nerve. They myelinate versus the oligodendrocyte. They myelinate the central nervous system. Here you see the nucleus of a Schwann cell, and here you see the axon that's labeled here, and then here you see an arrow going pointing to the basement membrane that wraps around every corresponding myelinated axon in the peripheral nerve. Versus in the oligodendrocyte, it myelinates more than one axon, and there is no basement membrane. And that becomes very important. We talked about that last week. One of the things about the brain, like any organ system, it has a limited response to injury. And the five injurious processes we're going to look at in the CNS is inflammation due to infections. Whether it's when you think of encephalitis, for example, or meningitis and leading to secondary encephalitis, you talk about ischemic injury to the brain, hemorrhages. The third category is problems of malformations or developmental issues. The third is neurodegenerative, as well as demyelinating diseases. And the last is neoplasia. When you have these types of categories of injury to the brain, what happens is we know that neurons are permanent cells, but the astrocytes are reactive to injury. They're like fibroblasts. You also are going to have the microglia that are going to be activated as well that are going to interact with these astrocytes. And so we call this basically gliosis. When you hear the word gliosis, it means there's a reactive process in response to some type of injurious process. So it's reflection. Think of the astrocytes as sophisticated cousins of fibroblasts. They're supportive in nature. They play a critical role in the function of tissues. And so here we see a immunoproxystane for GFAP, glial fibrillary acidic protein, you see the normal number of astrocytes, and then when you have injury, you see increased number. Their hyperplasia occurs in these cells that are reactive. Now, this also becomes important when you ask the question, what's the most common tumor found in the brain that's primary? It's from astrocytes, because they're stable cells. Neurons are permanent. They give tumors, but not as the frequency compared to astrocytes, because what happens to dividing cells, the mutation rate goes up, and we get further pro-oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes becoming activated or deactivated. So those are the astrocytosis, or gliosis is called, reactive. Here's an astrocyte forming the blood-brain barrier, and if you look carefully, here you see the astrocyte. Here you see the individual foot processes against the basement membrane of the tube formed by the endothelial cells, which would be inside the lumen. That is the blood-brain barrier. It's very selective to keep out various molecules that would be toxic to the brain, like bilirubin, for example. This is a slide not to memorize, but here's to show the important molecule, glucose, and how it's interacting with the astrocyte and neuron. See, these are the biochemical pathways of glycolysis and the Krebs cycle, or TCA, tricyclic acid cycle. And you can see the interaction becomes very, glutamine is a very important molecule that goes between acetate part of the whole glycolysis and how it becomes acetyl-coenzyme A and enters the TCA cycle. The two organelles at the bottom are the mitochondria, based, and then you can see the cytosol. So you can see how the astrocyte becomes very critical in the interaction between the neurons. They're around the neurons, they're supportive both in the gray matter and white matter, and so they play also a very critical role, because the neurons cannot store glycogen like you think of skeletal, cardiac cells, or hepatocytes. Here are microglial cells. This is a Indian ink preparation. We see the dendritic processes from the microglial cells, and they'll become activated in any of these conditions as part of the reactive gliosis. Remember, they're phagocytic, so they release cytokines. They're going to present antigens to the immune system. We don't have lymphatics. We don't have lymph nodes in the brain, but we do have islands or areas around perivascular areas. You have lymphocytes. So there's immunologic cells within the CNS, and they typically are quiescent. And they're the quiescent microglial cells. So let's talk about the CNS diseases. Now that we've given you the cast of characters in the plays that we're now in the scenes of these various conditions. So if you put all the conditions of the CNS on one slide, it would look something like this. One, infectious. If it involves the membranes, we call it what? Meningitis. If it involves the brain parenchyma or spinal cord, we call it encephalitis. So it's quite different. There are two sites that you think of that cause inflammation of the brain. Another critical area of the brain is hypoxia. And hypoxia can come in an infarct, hemorrhagic stroke, infarct stroke, and then bleeding and trauma. And we'll look at these as examples of this. Third is the brain is very complex in its formation, and therefore it is prone to malformations. The classic one you think of, neural tube defects, but that's been decreased during pregnancy because women take folic acid, an important one carbon transfer molecule that's important in the transfer and DNA synthesis. So the rate of neural tube defects like spina bifida or anencephaly is decreased dramatically because of the use of folic acid, that's increased utilization during pregnancy. Next one that's very common, and this is a group of people you'll be working with, are neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Lewy body dementia. These are classic examples of diseases. Demyelinating, we'll talk about multiple sclerosis in the CNS. And then it's mentioned in your syllabus about, in the peripheral nerves, they think of Guillain-Barré, which is an autoimmune disease, can be triggered by viruses like the Zika virus is one example that causes a hypersensory reaction type 4, where cytotoxic T8 cells come in and cause damage to your Schwann cells, or to the myelin. You make antibodies to the myelin. Hypersensory reaction type 2. There's several flavors of Guillain-Barré. The last but not least is neoplasia. The most common tumor to involve the brain tends to be metastasis. We've looked at it from lung, kidney, liver, multiple malignant melanoma, for example. These are examples. But you think of you think of those astrocytes that can divide. The majority of primary brain tumors tend to be gliomas. So in one slide, we've captured the essence. Now we're going to look at examples of this. We're going to look at a lot of growths to help illustrate this. I'm not so much interested in the I'll talk about the microscopic features, but it's the growths, and especially when you do imaging like CT scans, MRIs of the CNS, and various techniques. It's revolutionized basically neurology or neuropathology in terms of looking at what's going on. So infectious diseases. This is what a normal brain looks like. If we were to take out your brain and you were to examine it, this is what the base of the brain looks like. Starting from the anterior to posterior, you can see what we're looking at is the leptomeninges, which is the subarachnoid membrane, and the pia, which is attached to the surface by the foot processes of astrocytes. If you go from anterior to posterior, here is the frontal lobe. Here are the olfactory bulbs sitting right above your nasal sinuses. And then you think of the optic nerve. Here's the optic chiasm. The stalk of the pituitary be here in the midline. The pituitary is left in the cella, in the middle portion of the skull, above the sphenoid sinus in the skull, the mammillary bodies. And then this is the third cranial nerve. Here is the circle of Willis right here, giving off the various branches. Here is being formed posteriorly by the basal artery, and then you have the vertebral arteries come together as a Y over the surface of the pons. Here's the medulla. This is important for respiratory centers and cardiovascular. And here is the cervical portion of the spinal cord you see here. Here are the tips of the temporal lobes, and then here at the on the each side is the occipital lobes, and then this is the cerebellum with the Purkinje cells or neurons. So this is what your leptomeninges, they're very translucent, and your cerebral spinal fluid is clear fluid with very little, no inflammatory cells at all, normally. And so those are the cranial nerves 1, 2, and 3, and the mammillary bodies, and then the third cranial nerve, okay? This is what it looks like, yes. Leptomeninges is the subarachnoid membrane with a subarachnoid space, and then the pia, which is attached to the surface of your brain by the foot processes of the astrocytes. The arachnoid matter, you mean the dura matter. The dura matter is on the outside. It's attached to the skull. Yes, so you got three layers. So it's going to be the subarachnoid membrane that forms the subarachnoid space, which you have vessels in it. And are the cranial nerves or in the spinal cord, the ventral or dorsal rami. Then the last part of the leptomeninges is the pia. So the meninges is defined as the subarachnoid membrane and the pia. It does not include the dura matter. Got it? Okay, anybody else? All right. So here, looking at the surface of the brain, this is what the subarachnoid membrane looks like. Here's a subarachnoid space, and here we have a blood vessel. Well, actually, this is the blood vessel, the subarachnoid membrane would be on the top, and you have a blood vessel here, subarachnoid space. Then this is the pia. You can't see it. It's very thin. And then the foot process of the astrocytes, and here you see these triangular-shaped neurons in the gray cortex, and here is coming down to capillaries, where you would see the blood-brain barrier formed here, okay? All right, this is what meningitis looks like. It's purulent. Now you can't see the surface of the brain. It's swollen. This is an autopsy. The skull has been opened up. Here would be the forehead with this autopsy number, 1967, case 395. And here you can see all this green purulent exudate. This is pussy acute bacterial meningitis. The bacteria have different species depending upon what age you are. In you and I, when we get bacterial meningitis, it would be Streptococcus pneumoniae. If you're an adolescent, you worry about, or in colleges, you worry about Neisseria meningitidis, is an outbreak of meningitis as a consequence. Can you get meningitis as a newborn? Yes, because it comes from the birth canal. When you get vaginal delivery, the mother may have organisms like Listeria, or they may have streptococcus organisms that can be passed on and get into the leptomeninges and produce neonatal meningitis. But the most common form of meningitis is bacterial. Here you see nothing but pus in the subarachnoid space. Here is a blood vessel. Here is the pia that's attached. The foot processes have lost the ability to attach to the pia. It's this very thin membrane. And here you see a purulent exudate in response to the bacterial organism. Here is a Gram stain showing you streptococcal pneumonia organisms, Gram positive cocci. And here you see nothing but neutrophils as a consequence of this. How do we make the diagnosis of meningitis? It's usually a lumbar spinal fluid tap and clinical presentation. One of the complications or outcome of any type of infection we've talked about are abscesses, which is localized collection of pus in inflamed tissue. And so here's what it looks like on a CT scan, a ringing enhanced lesion, a cavitary lesion. Now this is looking from the patient's, basically from the feet to the head. So the patient's, this is an abscess on what side of the brain of the patient? The right. This is the left side. When we look at a coronal sections, it's the right is the right and the left is you looking from the back of the head or from the top of the head down. It's the opposite. You always have to remember that. So this is what it looks like now, looking from the top of the head to the feet, rather than the feet to the head on a CT scan or MRI. So here is a horizontal section, and here is the frontal lobe, here is the parietal lobe, here is the occipital lobe, here is the C-shaped lateral ventricles. Here's the choroid plexus. You can see that right here. And then you see a pus-filled cavity within the brain parenchyma. One of the complications that can occur with meningitis is brain abscesses. How does the abscess occur? Well, the blood vessels that are in the subarachnoid space on the surface of the brain will pierce into the brain parenchyma and take the extension of the subarachnoid space with it, and it's called the Virchow-Robin space, and then PMNs and bacteria can now flow into the brain parenchyma and then set up abscesses. Now you can also get abscess in the brain from ear infections. This is what happens. I had a case of a seven-year-old child who had ear infection. It wasn't treated, didn't get access to medical care because the cranial nerves come across and go, like, for example, the seventh and eighth cranial nerve coming into the area of the temporal bone where the ear is. If you get meningitis, it can use the cranial nerves as a conduit, like a bridge, to spread across into the brain. And that's how this person got an abscess. And they were 1 hour from dying from herniation, but they were able to drain it and relieve the intracranial pressure because of all the edema that was occurring in response to the inflammatory process. So here you can see there's edema, there's swollen, it's swollen in this area, and you can see the ventricles are being shifted to the left because of this. So when you have, remember, the brain is in a skull, very hard. Anything that expands the brain parenchyma, fluid, a mass, like an abscess, or a tumor, or anything that increases that mass, hemorrhage, that volume is going to cause a problem on that jello we call the brain and cause herniation as a cause of death. And there's the abscess. Chronic meningitis is typically, you think of fungal and bacteria, they're slow growing, like TB. TB has a very poor prognosis when it involves the meninges. It tends to involve the base of the brain. We're looking at the cerebellum, the pons. And you notice we don't see pus because this is chronic, but we see what is called clouding of the meninges. We see opacity, opaqueness, where we can't see the basal artery on the surface of the pons. Here you can see the optic chiasm. And so this is a chronic form of meningitis. And what the problem is when you have it in this location is what drains into the subarachnoid space at this part of the brain are the cerebrospinal fluid circulation through the fourth ventricle, through the foramen of Luschka-Magendi. So now that you have scarring or damage to the base of the brain, you plug up these holes that allow cerebrospinal fluid to flow up to the t- top of your brain, superior portion, and get reabsorbed by the subarachnoid granulation into your venous blood. So you've interrupted the circulation. So now the water accumulates within the ventricular system, within the brain, and you get what is called hydrocephalus, obstructive hydrocephalus, and that causes damage, permanent damage, if it's not relieved, the pressure. Plus, since it's the base of the brain, chronic meningitis like this can lead to cranial nerve palsies because of the damage. Those cranial nerves are being destroyed within the subarachnoid space by the inflammatory cells, lymphocytes, and macrophages releasing lytic enzymes and causing fibrosis and scarring, and so it can now compromise the cranial nerves. This is what a chronic TB looks like. You see a multinucleated giant cell with epithelioid cells and lymphocytes, so this is a form of chronic inflammation. Here's an acid fast stain showing you the acid fast bacillus leading to chronic TB meningitis. This is one that, like I say, is a very poor prognosis. Why? Because you remember you treat TB for over half a year, and this would have to require fecal injections of antibiotics, and so it becomes a real problem. You end up dying from it. This is when you have obviously disseminated TB as the portal of entry, being your respiratory tract. This is what happens in meningitis, whether it's acute or chronic. And here you see the exudate within the subarachnoid space. And then you see a blood vessel now piercing into the brain parenchyma. And you see this space where the black arrow is, or these black arrows, that's varicose Robin space. So if I'm an infectious agent and I'm in your meninges, I can now spread into the brain parenchyma and produce secondary encephalitis. The opposite is also true. If I have an encephalitis as the primary inflammatory process, I can now extend to the meninges and produce a secondary meningitis. So this is how organisms, as well as tumor cells, if they're in CSF, can spread very easily through the brain. And here is just a lumbar spinal tap. Do not memorize this. This is just to show you when you do an LP or lumbar spinal tap or puncture, and you're trying to make the diagnosis of meningitis, the normal values, the cells, the glucose, and the proteins and the pressure that's normally there. When you have purulent, you can see obviously thousands of neutrophils. That makes sense. That defines acute inflammation. Because the neutrophils are actively phagocytizing, migrating into the area of inflammation, it requires glucose under anaerobic state. So glucose goes down compared to normal. And because you increase vascular permeability, plus the cells are dying, they release proteins. The protein solute goes up, what attracts water in, and that's why the opening pressure is elevated as a consequence to this. When you have viral meningitis due to herpes, for example, or CMV, it's going to be lymphocytes, like cytotoxic A lymphocytes. Because they don't phagocytize, they don't use as much glucose, so it's either normal or slightly decreased, but proteins go up and slightly elevated. Then we talk about TB, for example, granulomatous. You see mostly lymphocytes and mononuclear cells, like they become macrophages. They are phagocytic, they use glucose, and then increase number of proteins, and because of increase of solutes within the cerebrospinal fluid, you retract water and you have opening pressure. So these are the things that one uses as a diagnostic tool to make the case for meningitis, whether it's acute or chronic. Any questions?
So bacteria will take your own glucose?
Yep, sure. But it's the PMNs that do it. You saw that it's not the medical students memorize for the boards that it's the bacteria that takes up the glucose. No, you saw only a few bacteria. You saw millions of PMNs. They're migratory. Remember I showed you the movie? And they're phagocytic. That takes a lot of ATP, doesn't it? So they're the ones that's consuming it, as well as the inflamed tissue. Viruses don't take up glucose. They're looking for a host cell to get into, and they're quite different. They're packaged RNA or DNA, and they tend to bring in a lymphocytic, so it'll go after the infected cells. The when you have viral meningitis, so it's not going to consume as much glucose, if at all. This is just as reference for you. One of the terms from bacteria to viruses, one of the things that causes a viral damage, and one of the times you're very susceptible to viral meningitis or encephalitis is neonatal period or the first couple years of life. If you look at the size of this brain, here you have a ruler at the bottom. You can see that this brain is about between 9 to 10 centimeters in length. Well, that's only 4 inches. If you think of the size of your brain is longer than 4 inches. And so this tells you this is a pediatric case. If you look carefully at the base of the brain for orientation, if you look carefully, you can see here's the cerebellum. So this is the occipital lobe. Here's the parietal lobe up here. Here's the temporal lobe on the right side. Here's the right frontal lobe. And you'll notice this temporal lobe is intact because I see the tip of the poles of the temporal lobe here. But here in this, the left temporal lobe is completely missing. And it's been destroyed because of herpes simplex viral encephalitis. When you get an encephalitis, most other encephalitises, when you see them due to a virus, are going to be basically cerebral edema and acute brain herniation and death. And they all look the same grossly. But the one virus that destroys the temporal lobe is herpes simplex. Herpes simplex likes squamous cells, the cellular tropism, and it also likes to go after neurons as a consequence of this. Why the temporal lobes? One thought is that because herpes simplex likes to go along cranial nerves in general, that you have the trigeminal nerve in the cavernous sinus, which is medial to the temporal lobes, and it can extend from that and adjacent and destroy the temporal lobes that way. And there's the temporal lobe on the right and the missing temporal lobe where the black is, you don't see it. Okay? This took a few years. So this is an older child, but got a meningitis due to herpes simplex. One of the things, if you get meningitis, whether it's bacterial or viral, before the age of one, the likelihood of mental retardation goes up. So one way of getting acquired mental retardation is having meningitis as in the neonatal period, because the CNS is developing and it can be a complication, especially those neurons in the gray cortex. This is what it looks like in herpes simplex encephalitis. You see nothing in the subright, you see a lot of lymphocytes. And so here you see a meningitis plus an encephalitis. You have inflammatory cells, and these holes represents edema. Another type of organism that can travel through the blood to your brain is fungus. And so one of the things, in order to have fungus go to your brain, you're obviously, if you have a fungal infection in the lungs, that's usually the portal of entry, whether it's coccidiomycosis or aspergillus, it can now travel hematogenously. Remember, 30 to 35% of your cardiac output goes to the CNS. And so, or the head and neck area, and here you can see this necrotic brain with hemorrhage in it. That's why it's brown. The right is the right. We're looking at, anybody have an idea what lobe we're looking at? Are we in the front or the back? You're in the front. These are the frontal lobes. And how you can tell right here, what's this is the anterior portion, your corpus callosum. That's usually an important landmark. You can tell where you're at. And so this is the anterior part of the brain. This is the frontal lobe. You can't see it, but down here would be the olfactory bulbs. We're farther past the olfactory bulbs. It would be at the base of the brain. That's a good place to look for it. Here you see the brain is normally white matter. Here's the gray matter. When we have necrotic brain, on a gross image, it looks like crumbling cheese. When I see crumbling cheese in the brain parenchyma, it's necrotic. And here you see the hemorrhage. So this is multifocal aspergillus encephalitis, necrotizing encephalitis. The next one, the last infectious cause, is prion diseases. I've done last 12, 14, 15 years working on prion diseases. Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease is the most common. I've done over 60 autopsies on these patients. And it is a problem of a misfolded protein called the prion protein. And it's associated, when you think of mad cow disease, where it's a variant of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, Kuru was what New Guinea was first described in the 40s and 50s, and it was due to cannibalism as a homage to people who died in the village. The children and the women would eat the brains that were infected, and they would get it just by eating it. So that's really the only way you can get it. You may have patients who have Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, not that common. The incidence is 1 in 1 million, 1 to 2 cases in 1 million in the human population. You have other forms of it, fatal familial insomnia, where you can, and obviously it's passed on genetically, and it, you never sleep. You think you have a hard time as students? And so you can get this progressive disease. Scrapie is found in sheep. You can find prion diseases in deer, sheep, cattle, cows, and it can be, so it's across different mammalian type of species that you can see this. But Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease by far is the most common or sporadic. Here you can see the incidence of, in terms of, or the prevalence per million. You can see it occurs in the 50s and then goes down after, like Alzheimer's, below the age of 90. Or above the age of 90, I should say. You don't see, because this is a rapid progressive course, it affects the frontal lobes. It leads to very much the similar presentation of dementia that one sees in Alzheimer's. And it's progressive. It's more, it has a rapider course than Alzheimer's, which can take over years to decades to take place. But this usually takes place within 2 to 8 months, is typically. There's some patients can go up to 3 years, but they're more a exception to the rule. They can start out with frontal lobe problems like yelling, screaming, abnormal behavior, shouting, disruptive behavior. It could be all sorts of things that are going to be quite the opposite. Then it can affect places like the hippocampus and lead to memory loss. Just like Alzheimer's, and progress and then lead to problems in the cerebellum and go down your brainstem. So it's a progressive process that can occur fairly quickly. What do the 99% of these patients die of? Like Alzheimer's, is because of the damaged neurodegenerative disease that's taking place in the brain. You die of aspiration pneumonia because you have diminished gag and cough reflex. That's what most people die of. Here you can see the brain looks grossly normal because it takes 2 to 8 months versus Alzheimer's. You'll see changes. We'll look at that when we get to the neurodegenerative. And what you see is what is called spongiform vascular degeneration within the neurons and axons. There's no inflammatory response like lymphocytes or PMNs that we've talked about before. So it has a very atypical pattern. So spongiform vascular degeneration of the neurons. This is what the protein, we all have the gene for PRPC. It basically, you have these alpha helical regions within the protein. In the scrapie form of the abnormal form, it becomes beta pleated sheets. So it's a conformational change that takes place. What is intriguing about this, once you get this conformational change from an alpha to beta pleated sheets, when it interacts with this alpha, with a normal PRPC, it will change its conformation and make it a beta pleated sheet, and now it propagates in that way. Hence the word prion. This is the model for it. Here you see a, basically this protein is transmembrane, the PRPC. There's some other factor they surmise that interacts. And you can see here's a normal PRP with a, now a the beta-pleated sheet, the abnormal PRP scrapie protein. And now it converts the conformation, that normal to an abnormal form, and that's how it propagates. It can go from your nerves, it tracks down your nerves and goes to your tissues. So if you eat infected tissue, whether it's meat, bone, organs, you can get it that way. So the only way to transmit this really is you have intimate contact. So people don't eat one's flesh. So that's not, if you have a patient, they can't cough on you and you get it that way. There's a rare cases of blood transfusion from a patient. But other than that, it has to be intimate contact. Okay. No, it's not a virus. It's a protein. It's a normal protein that we have that changes. If it has a mutation on amino acid 129, it can change its conformation from a alpha helical conformation to a beta pleated sheet conformation, and that's abnormal. It's not a virus.
It acts like a virus.
No, it's not. Doesn't even act like a virus. It's in a class in itself. Virus is going to be what? RNA and DNA, and they have a set of genes. There's only one molecule that's here. It's quite different. Yes. Yeah, like herpes simplex. That's a classic one.
Would bacteria?
Yes. That's why I said an ear infection. Ear infections are bacterial, typically.
What and if you, like, I mean, can any bacteria make a switch to the brain? Like, how does syphilis get its way in if it's not following?
Hematogenous. If a microorganism gets in the blood, where's the first place once it leaves the lung? Where's the place it's going to go? From the arch of the aorta goes what? Straight your head and neck. Remember, you have the arch of the aorta, all those great vessels coming up, the upper extremities and the head and neck. It's a great stop off. Any other questions? Yes.
There are the passages of the blood-brain barrier. You said that's only made up of the astrocyte processes.
And the basement membrane and the endothelial cells that line the blood vessels in the capillaries. Correct. Okay. Next category, cerebrovascular diseases. This is a common one. Will you be seeing people who have strokes? What do you think? Yeah, so hypoxia. We always return to every organ system, and the brain is no exception to this. So, all neurons are not the same in the brain. You always have to remember that clinically. Neurons carry out unique biochemical processes. They make unique neural transmitters. Therefore, there are certain ones in the brain that are extremely sensitive to the lack of oxygen or hypoxia. So now this is when you look at this diagram, this is when we talk about either hypoxia or infarction, where the brain dies because the lack of perfusion, localized. When you learn about the cerebral vessels, anterior, middle, and posterior, they are going to be on the surface of the brain and going to send down vessels down into the gray matter. But there are areas where they come together. These are called watershed areas. So if you have a shock, whatever the cause is, decreased perfusion, those two vascular beds supplying is going to have less perfusion and you can get infarction. For example, in this diagram, you can see that the anterior cerebral and the middle meningeal artery is right above the surface parasagittally off to the left. And that's where if you were in shock, you get an infarct or a stroke. Another place is, you can see that the last place to get blood supply is in the deep layers of the gray cortex. So if you have shock or you have a thrombus in a cerebral vessel due to atherosclerosis, which is the most common vascular disease, you get laminar necrosis along the gray matter with the neuronal cell bodies. Here's another watershed infarct. You can see the posterior and middle cerebral artery. One of the neurons that's very susceptible by hypoxic injury is the hippocampus. There is what is called summer sector, CA1, one area of those neurons in the hippocampus there that's very vulnerable to hypoxic damage. The next place is your cerebellum. The Purkinje neurons are very susceptible to hypoxic damage. So you can see when we talk about the loss of neurons due to hypoxia, there is selective areas, very unique areas that are affected in this process of hypoxia. So I put this diagram to remember that when you have decreased perfusion of the brain, whatever the cause is, this is where you start to get irreversible permanent damage to the CNS. So they're very unique in the distribution. So if it affected the cerebellum, you'd have to worry about ataxia, discoordination of limb movement, for example, because of the destruction to the cerebellum. Obviously, the hippocampus can interfere with memory. And then depending upon where the location of the infarct is on the various areas of the brain, you're going to have different areas of the body be affected. Okay? Question?
Is the watershed where the anastomosis exists? There's
no anastomosis. This is where it ends at both blood supplies. See, like that, you see the blood vessels? It's the last place to get oxygen, the first to die when there's a lack of oxygen to it. Okay? Now, what is the most common disease that you're going to see with involving the cerebral vessels in middle age to older people is atherosclerosis, just like we talked about the coronary arteries, the aorta, and the peripheral vessels. So here you see a patient on the base of the brain showing the circle of Willis. Here's what your basal artery looks like. You can see right here, it's nice and translucent, versus the one on the right, you see those yellow plaques of atherosclerosis that can now lead to thrombus formation and then lead to basically infarct because of lack of perfusion to that area of the distribution of that blood vessel that's occluded. Obviously, how long did it take to get atherosclerosis? What's the unit of time? Seconds, minutes, hours, months, weeks, years, decades. Decades. There you go. So that does not, yours, you're not old enough to get it yet. Too young. Me, my age, if I had the risk factors, I would. Now, what happens to an infarct? This is for reference. You're not going to be on the exam, have to regurgitate this. But when we talk about an infarct, when somebody has a stroke, that's a clinical term. You have to think of two broad categories. Either they've blown out a blood vessel, a hemorrhagic stroke, or they've infarcted a region of the brain because of lack of perfusion, like due to atherosclerosis, due to a thrombus in that lumen. So infarcts are described in the following way, very much in the same way we talked about infarct in the heart. So when we have an acute infarct, somebody has an acute infarct stroke, what's going to happen is the neurons will start to die. Because of the blood-brain barrier, it takes a while for the chemical gradients to occur, and you don't see any neutrophils. You see maybe some neutrophils, but it's usually greater than 24 hours before they start to arrive. Remember, in a microinfarct, they're within 6 hours they began to arrive. So it's a little different, but the sequence is the same. Then, as a function of time, as the neurons die, they're going to be fagocytized by the activated microglial, and now you see macrophages coming in. And they're going to be starting to come in just like in an infarct, and you have reactive astrocytosis starts to occur after a week. We call this evolving or a subacute infarct, and this can be up to 1 month or so because it takes time, and depending upon how large the infarct is. Then eventually what happens is, as the macrophages fagocytize the dead brain, remember what cells missing in the brain are fibroblasts. So you can't lay down a scar tissue like you can do in the heart or the liver or the kidney. Since there's no fibroblasts, what you're going to end up with is a hole or a cystic space filled with cerebrospinal fluid. So if you look on a CT scan, you've got now permanent irreversible damage at this point chronically. So we call this a remote infarct. And so you get a reactive astrocytosis, you get an increased astrocytes, you produce what is called a glial scar around it. Okay. This is what it looks like in the acute phase. And if you draw a line down the middle of the brain, and when you look at brains, you always look at the base of the brain. What do we see here is the optic chiasm. So at that level of the brain, here you see the corpus callosum, here are the lateral ventricles, and here is the caudate nucleus, the head of the caudate nucleus. Here is the internal capsule coming through here. And then if you look, draw a line down the middle of the brain, you notice which side of the brain is enlarged is the right side. And you can see that the gyri are flattened against the surface of the skull. Here they're convexity to the surface. And you don't see the gray-white junction, so this is what acute infarct. That's why they get the swelling in the brain in the acute infarct, because you've damaged it. And because you don't have lymphatics, you can't get rid of the fluid. And you notice the brain is kind of shifting to the left, since this is a infarct of the right parietal lobe, because at the level of the optic chiasm. And there's the infarct. Then you can also have secondary hemorrhage into the infarcted area, because the last structure to break down would be your blood vessels within the brain that's infarcted. Now you get secondary transformation or hemorrhage within the infarcted area. Obviously, when there's blood, it takes longer to reabsorb. It takes 4 hours to eat one red blood cell as a macrophage, in this case, the microglia. Then, when you look at it microscopically, you see this triangular pale area. This is the white matter right here. Here is the sulcus. Here is the gray cortex. And you see this area, triangular shape, is the infarct, is the edema. That's why it looks pale. And you see these red brick nuclei. And here's what it looks like. Here's what a normal neuron looks like with a prominent nucleolus and nucleus. But then when you look at these neurons over here, you see these dying neurons. So this is in the first 24 hours. That's why you can't really look at a patient and decide what's their residual neurologic status going to be, because you got edema, you don't know how many neurons are dying, so it takes time before later on do you know the full extent of the infarct. At first it can look very dramatic, and then as a function of time, once the edema, the hemorrhage, if it's there, and the number of neurons, it takes time before to have a true assessment of the what's remaining that has survived this catastrophic event to the neurons. So that's what dead neurons look like. But what cell is not here you don't see a lot of? Which cell? What inflammatory cell? Neutrophils, that's right. So it tells me this is in the first 24 hours. This is what a subacute infarct looks like. Here we see this is the frontal lobes. We're past the corpus callosum because you see no union between the frontal lobes. And here you see uniform white matter and gray matter. But then on this side, you see the gray cortex, and it looks like crumbling cheese because the macrophages have been activated. They've come in and they're starting to eat the dead brain. So it was an infarct on the left side. You can see it down here as well. What artery was this? This is probably part of the, this is mostly the middle meningeal artery and some of the anterior. When you look at it microscopically, what do we see? Angiogenesis, we see macrophages everywhere. And here is the inside the dead area, we see nothing but obese macrophages satiated by dead brain as it's now being reabsorbed. As it becomes a remote infarct, here we see nothing but what? On the left side, a hole or a cystic space. Is that going to be reversible or irreversible process? Irreversible. Now you'll know exactly what the extent of the injury at this point as the brain is being healing and reabsorbing the dead parenchyma, you'll find out the true residual effect of the CNS once it gets down to this point, obviously. And here you see a closer view. You have glial scar, you have reactive astrocytes at the edge. There's no fibroblast, so you're not getting a fibrous wall outlining the outside of it. Okay? This is what it looks like microscopically. Here you see the gyrus. Your gyrus here. Here's the sulcus. You see blood vessels in the subarachnoid space. And you see nothing but a hole and organization along the gray matter and extending into the white matter down here. Here you see nothing within the cavity. You see these round cells or macrophages that have eaten the dead brain. So this is where it's going to become nothing but a hole. And at the edge of the brain that's now been damaged, you have all these astrocytes that have a lot of reactive protein or GFAP, glial fibrillary acidic protein, and these are what's forming the glial scar. So when you hear the word glial scar, you think of astrocytes that's formed around the dead brain in this remote infarct. And those are the macrophages, and those are the reactive astrocytes in blue. So the black is the macrophages, and then the blue arrows are pointing to the gliosis, in this case, the reactive gliosis and the astrocytes, and plus the macrophages, okay? All right, we'll take a break, come back, finish up the CNS. Any questions?
This podcast was recorded by Dr. Henry Sanchez at the University of California, San Francisco.